proceed now to the fifth case, Ballinger versus the United States. Mr. Kish.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Kish. I'm counsel for appellant J. Scott Ballinger. This is an appeal from the denial of a 2255 habeas motion. There's really two theories of relief, it seems like. One is ineffective assistance of counsel, which Mr. Ballinger pled, and the second is this court's suggestion that the party brief the question of whether the due process considerations of this case render some relief for Mr. Ballinger. It seems to me also that the heart of both of these issues, in other words, my client can't get any relief whatsoever, deals with the contours of 18 United States Code Section 247.
Mr. Kish, forgive me, and I really do mean forgive me, but I'm going to ask you a question which may be coming out of left field for you.
Yes, ma'am.
But I did note that you were one of Mr. Ballinger's lawyers, and according to the government, you were present at both the plea and the sentencing hearings in the Southern District of Indiana, that Mr. Riggs told the district court that both you and he had spoken to Mr. Ballinger at length concerning the plea agreement, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there is a Ninth Circuit case, United States versus Del Muro, which was decided in 1996, that has found an attorney has an actual conflict of interest to argue his own ineffectiveness. That was in the context of a post-trial motion. So I really need to know where you stand on that issue. And
yes,
of course,
ma'am. Let me explain if I can.
Yeah.
Here's what happened. Mr. Ballinger was committing arsons all over the country. He gets arrested in Indiana when he about burns himself up. He confesses to everything. One of the first things that happened is that his confession to an arson in Georgia, which resulted in the death of a firefighter, causes the United States attorney in my district to say, we're going for the death penalty. I'm immediately appointed. That's common. I never make an appearance in Indiana, but of course I consult with Steve Riggs, who I've known for years, to make sure that nothing that Mr. Riggs and Mr. Ballinger do in the handling of the cases here in the Seventh Circuit has any deleterious effect on the potential death penalty case in Georgia. I never make an appearance, but I obviously do, as they pointed out, consult with Mr. Riggs. I even came up here and looked at some of the evidence. Eventually, Mr. Ballinger is sentenced in Indiana, and he makes his very first appearance in Georgia. We've never filed a pleading in the Georgia case. It's at that point that we, in Georgia, start looking at the actual contours of the charges, because by that point, the government has dropped its choice to go for the death penalty. And it's at that point that we actually start looking at, you know, the interstate commerce question. So to say the question of whether I am arguing my own ineffectiveness, I don't think is appropriate, because I was never representing Mr. Ballinger on any of the cases that are before the court here. I was indeed in consultation with his attorney, and I don't feel terribly good about calling Steve Riggs ineffective. He's a friend of mine. We've practiced together. But I think that the issues are in common, and that's the context in which this came up, Judge Rodner. Mr. Ballinger still has cases ongoing. I think he's facing a trial in about 3 or 4 weeks down in Georgia in state court, where obviously these interstate commerce issues have no impact.
That's my second question to you. Are there state charges pending, and only in Georgia?
As far as I know, only in Georgia, but that's a felony murder case for the arson that resulted in the death of the firefighter there.
And even though the statute has been off.
But that's the federal statute.
No, I know.
Yes, ma'am. But that's what happened, and I do understand your question, but we then get back to the what I think in some respects are the bigger questions, which is how does a court construe Section 247? The 11th Circuit's already given its spin on it. And that then fits into the bigger picture of this development in the last 10 years of the intersection between the Commerce Clause and common law crimes in federal court. And our little history lesson here, we all know, is that back in 1996, the way this statute was written, the actus reus portion of it was the same as it is now, which is that it's a crime, obviously, for anyone to intentionally deface, damage, or destroy religious real property. What has changed is the fact that it has to be in certain, quote, circumstances. Back in 1996, those circumstances were that it focused on the offender, not the offense. Back then it said, in committing the offense, the defendant travels in interstate commerce or uses a facility or instrumentality.
I think we have to talk about the prejudice on the ineffectiveness because 844H would have given him 20, 40, 60, 80, 90 years. Three of those charges were dropped, correct?
Correct, but Judge, if the underlying arson, there's not enough fact form, you can't get what I call the piggyback 844H1 charges, which have the consecutive sentence. It's similar to 924C, the use of the if the underlying bank robbery didn't happen, you can't get the extra 924C.
Now, 844H can't stand alone.
Exactly. That's why I
it
say...
It would have to piggyback onto the 247.
Yes, ma'am.
Which has been found unconstitutional by 2-1.
Not unconstitutional, but unconstitutional as applied under facts that are virtually identical to the facts in this case. And that's why I suggested that maybe our jumping off point here should be the contours of 247 and the fact that Congress explicitly took out language requiring travel or use of instrumentality, and instead they put in this language that the offense, remember, no longer the offender, but the offense is in or affect interstate commerce. Now the government, I think, is making two basic arguments as to why they think they still win. One, their first argument is, well, this language in or affect interstate or foreign commerce is sort of shorthand. It's like a Congress is putting up a signal. This is what we really mean. The problem, of course, is that those are the precise English language words they took out of the statute. The second problem with that argument is that if you look at all the other sections in the U.S. Code that I cited in our brief and that the 11th Circuit mentioned, when Congress wants to make the traveling in commerce or the use of instrumentalities the jurisdictional hook, they sure know how to say so because they've done it over and over and over again. Furthermore, as the 11th Circuit pointed out, just because a few members of a committee said this is what they meant, that's not necessarily what the law really said. Now, the government's backup argument is again, to rely on the legislative history. And again, that's why I cited to the 11th Circuit's treatment of that issue, and they said, however attractive that might be, because this is a very good law designed to deter very bad conduct, you've got to deal with the statute, with all due respect, the way that it's written. You can't simply go on what a few legislators said during the deliberative process.
Could he have decided to challenge the 844I charges and still plead to the 247 charges?
Of course he could have. But I think the government's more or less conceding the 844I charges, what I call the omnibus arson charges, and with good cause. I mean, the case law is fairly evenly split, but I think that there is a very difficult construction for those charges to be valid. That's why I said it seems to me that we're really on the 247 counts, because if I can't win those, I can't get any relief for Mr. Ballinger. But then we get back to this bigger question of what is the proper construction of 247. And as we know, what the 11th Circuit said in looking at this decades-long, what I call a revolution in federal criminal law dealing with this intersection of commerce and crime, is they said that when it is a purely intrastate activity, and that intrastate activity and the elements of the crime don't require traveling or the use of an instrumentality or those first two of the Lopez categories, you then have to have a substantial impact on interstate commerce. And we know from Morrison, the gender violence case, you can't use a macro view. You can't aggregate all of the little, they're not little, they're big to the churches, but all of the individual church violence to find an impact on commerce. You have to look at the specific crime. And each one of these churches, the government conceded in its stipulation, are small. They're all very rural. They have very small congregations. And their interstate commerce connections are minimal at best. They involve the same sorts of things that the Supreme Court in Jones, construing the omnibus arson statute, said are not enough. They are the sorts of contacts like insurance, utilities, and things of that nature. I will wait for rebuttal. The court has questions.
Yeah, just one question, Mr. Bishop. Are you prepared to state to us that you did not discuss the possibility of challenging the statutes with his attorney?
I am. I wish I was smart enough to have come up with such a plan like that, but no, sir.
In the conversation that you related earlier to Judge Rose.
I'll state that as an officer of this court.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Stone.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Linda Tomey. I represent the United States in this appeal.
I'd like to turn directly to the 247 issue.
Before you do, could you just answer this for me? Do you believe that Mr. Kish is conflicted out of this case?
We don't believe that he's conflicted out of this appeal. We actually looked at this question when he was first appointed to the court, or appointed by the court to this case. Because there's no record on his participation in the negotiations or in advising his client in this case, we're dealing with really right now what Mr. Riggs did. We think that the, as we noted in our case, in our brief, Mr. Kish was present, and according to Mr. Riggs, he did discuss the plea with Mr. Ballinger. We think the relevance of that is that it simply indicates one more way in which Mr. Ballinger has a gap in his evidence. It was his obligation to allege what deficiencies there were in his counsel's performance. And he failed to allege anything about what he was advised by Mr. Kish. Because those facts are not before the court, we don't think that Mr. Kish is currently conflicted out of this appeal.
But it's Mr. Kish who would have had to have done that.
And if that was the case, then he would not have been able to handle this appeal. And if this were in the district court and there was an evidentiary hearing on what had happened, then I think Mr. Kish would have been conflicted out. In our view, it doesn't matter what Mr. Kish did or did not advise Mr. Ballinger, because in our view, the 247 counts were so strong and it is so clear that there was no colorable basis for challenging those, the factual basis for them. It really doesn't matter whether or not Mr. Kish or Mr. Riggs discussed the interstate commerce evidence with Mr. Ballinger.
You know, there is something about Section 247 counts, and that is, didn't the government miscalculate when it yielded an 87 to 108 month sentencing range? Because here's the way I was looking at it. It should not have started with a base offense level of 24, because that offense level is tied to the underlying offense of the 844 I charges. An accurate assessment of the risk of a multiple 247 conviction would look at those convictions alone, because he would have had his 844 I charges dismissed if he challenged them. So the offense level for each of the Section 247 charges would have been 12. Then after a three-level victim-related adjustment, it would have been 15, and the sentencing range would have been 24 to 30 months, which gives us a 40 to 50-year range. And, of course, he was sentenced to 42 years.
Judge, I'm not sure. I haven't looked at that specifically, but
yeah, I know.
The parties, the court, and the probation office all agreed that that was the correct calculation. I believe that the base offense level was based on the 247, not the 844I. It may be the same guideline, because they're both arson.
Uh-huh.
Rather than, there may be other kinds of violations of 247, for example, threats or defacement of a building. In this case, I suspect that the base offense level was based on arson, because it was the same offense, whether it was 240, the same conduct, whether it was 247 or 844I. As for the sentencing, what we have looked at on this is that even if you take out the 844Is, the sentence would have been exactly the same, based just on the 247s. Because when you, under Section 3D1.4 of the guidelines, when you add together the counts, there were so many counts that once you get to five counts, you add the same, you have the same upward adjustment. And there were 247 counts. Once you get past five, you don't add anything in addition. So even subtracting the 844Is would not make a difference in the calculation of the sentence. It's clear that the plain language of 247 covers the defendant's conduct in this case. The statute, the interstate commerce element of the statute, is that the offense is in or affects interstate commerce. Number one, that signals Congress's intent to use the full scope of its commerce power. There's no question, no one disputes that Congress has the authority to criminalize crossing state lines to commit a criminal offense. Second, the 11th Circuit and petitioner are simply wrong when they
say that the offense in this case is nothing but damage or destruction of real property. An essential element of this crime is that the offense is in or affects interstate commerce, just as an essential element of the crime is that the damage or destruction was undertaken because of, for religious reasons. Because it's an integral element of the case, the offense includes the interstate commerce connection. In that sense, in this context, the offense is interstate travel to commit the offense, followed by the commission of the offense itself, of damage or destruction to the church.
I know you analogized, of course, to 922 G1, illegal, you know, firearm. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't find, when I say we, my chambers, couldn't find cases in which the defendant and not the gun had traveled across state lines.
Well, I think that actually makes it easier.
You just,
because here we have someone in, under the felon in possession statute, in the cases this court and the Supreme Court have considered, it may have been, nobody even has to show when the gun crossed state lines or whether the defendant had anything to do with that. Here we have a course of conduct in which the defendant's travel from state to state was an integral part of this string of church arsons. For a period of 5 or 6 years, he traveled from state to state as a transient for the purpose of committing church arson. That's what he did.
But then how do we deal with the fact that 247 doesn't explicitly refer to crossing state lines, and the language that referred to the travel across state lines was deleted in 1996.
Well, there are two answers to that. First is the Felon in Possession Act does not refer to the gun crossing state lines. It refers to possession in interstate commerce, and the Supreme Court and this court have construed that to mean if the firearm crossed state lines, that constitutes possession in interstate commerce. Similarly here, the offense is in interstate commerce if the defendant has crossed state lines in order to commit it. The second answer to that is that it's clear from the legislative findings that Congress made when it amended the church arson statute in 1996 that it found the previous version of the statute to be insufficient, and that it was intending to broaden. This is without even looking at the legislative history. If you just look at the statutory findings, it was intending to broaden the applicability of that statute, and it would be very strange if it had adopted a narrower interstate commerce element.
Now, three of the 247 charges involve conduct that occurred before Congress changed the language of the statute. At the time Ballinger committed three of the offenses, the statute still had the language about traveling across state lines, and he admitted to traveling across state lines. Now, we looked at the record to see if the charging documents charged him with the old or the new language, but we couldn't find those in the record. So I'm wondering, did the three offense occurs? Okay, the three offenses occurred, right? While the old statute was in effect?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I had looked at this and I thought that all of the offenses that occurred before the amendments were charged under 844I.
Would it change anything?
If some of the 247s were before? The only thing it would change is, we think both the current and the former statute applied to his conduct. Under the former statute, they would be misdemeanors and not felonies. But my review, and I will look at this and get back to the court on it, when I looked at the plea agreement and the recitation of each of the offenses, I believe that all of the 247s occurred after the statute was amended, and that it was the 844Is were all beforehand.
Do you know, you wouldn't know if the charging documents referred to travel or if they...
I don't believe they did. I believe
they tracked the line.
They may have asserted those facts, but I believe they just referred to the offense being in or affecting interstate.
So another
facts they alleged, I'm not certain of.
Okay. So in other words, they tracked only the language of the amended statute. I mean, I'm just at a loss because we don't have this stuff.
Uh-huh. Well, what he was charged with for the plea was the information. Rather than an indictment for the Indiana charges. most of the 247s were. We will get those documents and supply them to the court.
That would really be, I think, helpful for all of us.
They were not in the record?
Are there any other state charges against him? Would the record tell us that?
I don't know if there are. I don't believe there are any other state charges pending. The one thing the court might want to know is that our petition for rehearing in the 11th Circuit is still pending.
That was my last question. You asked for en banc years ago.
And a little over a year ago. It was January of 2003. We checked yesterday with the 11th Circuit, and the petition is still pending. Unless the court has any other questions.
When you checked, does that mean somebody agreed that they're still thinking about it, or has everybody forgotten?
We just talked to the clerk's office, who have told us that it has not been ruled on. They haven't granted or denied. They haven't asked you for. I don't believe they've asked anybody to file a response. It's still pending.
It sounds like one that's lost in the shuffle.
It may have been. Now, I filed a brief in another 11th Circuit case involving this statute, although it involves very different issues, and we cited that case and put after it petition for rehearing pending and hope that might alert somebody in the 11th Circuit they need to do something. But that was last fall. We still haven't heard anything from the 11th Circuit.
Thank you,
Tommy. If the court has any questions, I'd urge the court to affirm the dismissal of the petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kish.
To answer your question, there was a story in the local legal paper about how it had been pending for so long, and the chief judge even answered questions about not the substance of the case, but just saying, you know, they were aware of it. And I know that the 11th Circuit has granted an en banc review in another Interstate Commerce Clause case recently. That's the answer I can give you. The felon in possession statute analog. As I mentioned in my reply brief, to me they're very different in a lot of ways. One of the major ways is the thing that has to cross state lines in felon in possession statute, I mean, there's pages and pages of federal regulation of that substance, a gun, whereas religion, obviously, is not regulated. But even more importantly, think of the logical extension of the government's point. In the felon in possession statute, the gun could have crossed the state line 100 years ago. And if I'm a felon, current possession of it is a federal crime. The government surely can't be saying that if Mr. Ballinger went from Ohio to Indiana at age 2 and then later, 30 years, foolishly commits a crime, that therefore they have a jurisdictional hook. That's the problem, is that how far back do you construe the passage? Is that, for example, if you look at the stipulated factual basis, there are long swaths of time in between.
You may finish your
thank time. You, sir. In between certain of the arsons, meaning were there travel? Was there use of facilities in that period? That's the problem with the construction that the government is urging here. And that's why, again, I think this is a very close issue, and as I mentioned in my earlier remarks, this fits into this recent 10-year debate.
Are you suggesting that the legislation, Mr. Kish, would actually have to have a time frame for a reason? Otherwise, a court couldn't take a reasonable construction? I mean,
here's what I would do if I was writing the law to make it right. If you travel in interstate commerce with the intention to commit an arson, you can have that case brought into federal court. Or if you use an instrumentality of interstate commerce as a part of your crime. One horrible recent example I thought of were these bombings in Spain where they detonated the devices within interstate commerce facilities in Spain, but the same thing. They used a cell phone. That would be commission using.
How would the government establish when the intention was formed? If you traveled from an adjoining state to the next state, mm-hmm. and you bought all the ingredients necessary to commit the bomb in the state where you firebombing in the state where it occurred, wouldn't you be arguing that there's no way the government could establish when the unless there was some writings or conversation? I mean, I'm just saying we don't have that. Would the statute you suggest possibly survive, or could it ever be established, I guess?
I think it could, Judge, when you look at all the other statutes that require that exact same thing, which the government seems to be able to prove relatively easily.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
To all counsel from the government.